The Standing Orders Podcast.
Welcome to this latest edition of the Standing Orders Podcast with me, Dr. Thomas Foreman, and my co-host, the Emeritus Mayor, Sue Lorne.
Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how are you?
Are you?
Oh, not this again.
Everything's good, thank you very much.
Good.
How's things with you?
Yeah, everything's going well.
Anything exciting to report?
Nothing exciting, actually, this week to report. Actually, I'm thinking, was there something I had to report that was exciting?
No, nothing
I can probably, at this point, mention. But tons of stuff politically, very interesting.
What
this
a week
has
been.
Obviously, well, hasn't it, just with the by-election that's happened in Rochdale and the election of George Galloway back into Parliament. I think the first time in, it must be a couple of decades since George Galloway's been in Parliament. And as little said as possible about that, the better, I think.
Oh, I don't know. I think
trust me, this is an apolitical podcast. And so don't get
I'm just saying that people need to wake up and realise that things are very, very different out there to what they've ever been.
I never know when we say stuff like that. I mean, I always take kind of how things are at the moment and think, blimey, has anything been like that? I mean, you look at the royal family and you think, blimey, you know, really kicking off with the royal family, or blimey, you know, in politics, you know, there's people on the right and there's people on the extreme left and there's so much division. And then actually you look back and you look at the 20s and the 30s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and you think, actually, I mean, I left the 40s out. But obviously, there was a huge kind of, you know,
they are the most important years.
You know, but actually, you know, all of it, like there was huge division. There was huge kind of issues. There was, you know, mass fear around, you know, nuclear warfare and all of this.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're in the same position as we were then. And, kind of, you know, you look at the abdication in the royal family. And you look at what's happening now, and actually it's nowhere near as kind of, you know, as interesting as it was then. But I guess it kind of feels like we're having all of those decades all shoved into a few years at the moment. And so, you know, it kind of does feel a little bit pressured. And I was even thinking, you know, last night I was reading through some bits and pieces on kind of where we are in terms of the sector at the moment on the MJ. And the one thing that really struck me is, you know, we're now coming up to 4 years post-COVID, like the first announcement of lockdown and understanding what COVID meant. And I was thinking, you know, it's still with us. And it's still, you know, our lives, at least my life, has changed significantly in terms of, you know, if I go to, you know, a hospital to visit someone, if I, you know, generally need to go and visit anyone who may be vulnerable, I still take a COVID test. I wear a mask to go to the hospital. I have to take a COVID test before I go in and stuff, just to make sure that everything's okay. And actually, it really has changed the way that I think about things. And, you know, you see someone in the supermarket coughing, and I don't mind telling you, you know, I've nearly knocked them over with a trolley. Yeah, absolutely. The amount of people I hold my breath going past.
Really?
Yeah,
oh my goodness.
Absolutely.
I'm amazed. Do you know, I don't even think about it.
I do not think about COVID. You see, this is why we do this online as opposed to in person, because you're crawling.
No, and I really don't know many people who do, you know, who do think about it so much anymore. Maybe it's the environment I'm working in. I don't know.
What, a hospital? I don't think about healthcare that much anymore.
No, but this is the thing. It just changed. It just seemed as though we had 3 years of everybody being so careful and, you know, coming home from work, having to take your clothes off, put them straight into the washing machine, and then, you know, and then think
about
your
family. I wondered where this was going for a second.
But literally, that's, you know, you got changed, put the clothes in the wash, you know, wash your hands constantly. I still, things like that will always stay with me now. Whereas not before, put my clothes into the washing
never,
machine.
Never saw soap and water from one week to the next.
every day, you know, that does not, it doesn't come in, COVID does not come into my mind as often as it did. It literally is a thing of the past. And it's just like the flu. And, you know, even whenever somebody says, you know, I've got a really bad cough or feel poorly, working in a hospital, I wouldn't be allowed to take time off if I had COVID and no. I wasn't really bored with it. No, you're not. It doesn't class as, it's only if you feel really ill that you then can have the time off. But no, you.
I don't know. Maybe it's just
wear a mask if you wanted to, but even that doesn't say there's no guidelines that say that you should stay at home anymore.
No, I still sanitize my hands every time I go to the supermarket. I still give it the trolley a wipe. I just, I can't quite get it. And sometimes, you know, if depending upon where it is and if someone's, you know, if I've heard a faint cough from some area, I always give a bit of a sanitization of the items. But I have to say, one of the things that, you know, I was thinking this week about, you know, basically what I was going to talk about. Shall I say? So is it just me? Sometimes.
Yeah, it's just you.
When you really focus on something, like I was thinking about how this happened was, talk about COVID. So I was in a supermarket and someone kind of coughed and literally I could see a bit of kind of cough mist going towards what I wanted.
No,
and so
that's bad.
I deliberately didn't then buy what I wanted because I saw kind of this coughing motion near it, and I was like, it's just not worth it. Yeah, it's just not worth it. But then I kind of feel like at the moment, you know, when you, and I don't know if you do it, but do you ever have in your mind, like, I'm going to be so careful doing this because I don't want, like, what I imagine could happen to happen. So what happened was I'm awful with chicken. I hate dealing with chicken. I like eating chicken, like chicken
but
generally.
You just don't like.
But I don't like handling raw chicken because I have this kind of fear that I'm going to poison people with salmonella, so or poison myself with salmonella. So I'm always incredibly careful with chicken. But anyway, I got this chicken and I sanitized all the surfaces so I was ready to do it. I got the pan out, I did everything, got the chicken out of the plastic, which always folds the wrong way, the way you don't want it to go, to make life just a little bit more difficult. At the plastic bag, which then you have to watch where it is all the time. So I managed to get it across, make sure it wasn't dripping or doing anything, put it in the pan, started dealing with kind of, it's like a roasting dish, dealing with it. And I just, you know, thought I'm going to cut the elastic that kind of ties the legs.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be so careful so it doesn't spray anywhere, like, or do anything. So I was literally, like, just precision cutting, and then the bloody elastic band pinged and juice from the chicken sprung and went on my mouth. And you know when you sit there and you just freeze frame and you're just like, how on earth does this happen when everything I was wanting to achieve was just like, keep it here, and everywhere it could go, it just covered my face, it sprayed all over my top, it went everywhere. And I was just, and the same thing happened yesterday. I'm brining some sorry, this is me like going off on tangent a bit.
I know, we've gone from George Galloway to chicken
to try and do some. I want to try and make pastrami, so I thought brine my beef, and so I'm really careful because I'm using curing salts.
Yes,
like I'm always really careful because I know they're not good for you.
Yes,
so I made this brine, did everything, vacuumed, like, I didn't vacuum pack the bag, I just sealed it.
Yeah,
there was a slight like fold on the bag, so I thought I will seal it twice.
Yeah,
so I did it twice, everything fine.
Yeah.
Went yesterday and gave it a little bit of a move just to get it going.
Yeah.
Shut the fridge door, and then I just heard this gush. And I looked down, and this brine was going everywhere, and it just like fell. And I think the pressure of the water went on this, and it just, I lost half the brine, like everywhere. And I just couldn't believe. And I just sat there, you know, when you think, like, like, why is this happening?
Because,
like,
you're just trying, like, too hard.
And I genuinely think when you have in your head, I do not want this to happen.
Yeah.
You life, do something to make it happen, just to make your life more difficult.
Fate just does it and makes you think, you're just being too fussy. And then
honestly,
it just you
well,
survived it, didn't you?
It's nice that you've finally found a way to just tell me I'm being too fussy.
But
I've been looking for an excuse to say
both
this.
Of those situations, didn't you?
Well, I don't know.
Yes, but you did, because you're here now. So
I did. But I feel like a little bit of me was chipped away each time.
No, but just going back to chicken, and this is probably the most ridiculous podcast we've ever done. Go back to chicken. You always use a thermometer. Whenever you get it to the right temperature, then you know that you're not going to poison anybody.
I do. It's just the preparation, the handling.
Once
it's in the oven, I'm fine with it. And sometimes I smoke the chicken.
Yeah.
So I kind of do a kind of the beer can smoking on the barbecue. And then I do use a thermometer. But then, like, sometimes I've done it. And when I've had people over, I've cut the chicken and it's reached the right temperature. The two thermometers have told me it's the right temperature independently. And I cut it. And it looks pink.
Because you haven't rested it long enough.
It was because I smoke it. It doesn't do the same colour thing as if you roast it. But that just plays psychologically with me. And so, like, this makes me sound even worse, but, like, the next day, I always drop people a text to make sure they're okay. I don't say, was everything okay after you ate the chicken last night? Because I don't want it to seem like...
But now everybody is going to know every time that they go there.
Fortunately, no one I know ever listens to this because they hear enough from me in real life. But it's just one of those things where I always drop a message just to make sure everyone's okay. And when everyone's like, oh, yeah, everything's great. I really enjoyed last night. Everyone's fine. I'm just like, thank God for that. But I don't know what I'd do if they said no, I'd be really ill.
They end up at A&E.
Yeah, through the eye of a needle. But there we are. So anyway, moving on slightly.
George
I think
Galloway.
That was probably a beautiful 5 minutes. Yeah, so in short... actually, I might be, but I'm not cooking it, so it's fine.
Okay,
sometimes
then.
I watch other people cook
doesn't
chicken,
that worry you
and
more,
it just gives me nightmares.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Just going back to George Galloway. So when I said, no, I think that maybe this is, interesting times, I think that it's a wake-up call. And I think every party needs to understand that they cannot just take anything for granted anymore. And I think that's how it's been for so many years. Labour have just sat back and thought, yeah, our supporters are going to come out. Conservatives, our supporters are going to come out. Well, maybe they just might not. They might come out,
yeah,
but not to support you.
I kind of think, it's a difficult one because I actually think, in terms of political parties, a lot of political parties now come out and actively don't want to, even on the back of, really good election results. They always come out with we're not taking anything for granted. There's still an awful lot of work to do. They say all of that. I never really understand the follow through from that, other than the lip service that they play. And I think, if anything, I would hope, I can't say hope. I would think perhaps that there was a protest vote going on once Labour kind of withdrew their support for their candidate, which was probably perhaps the right thing to do, but much too late. In fact, when I say probably, definitely the right thing to do, but definitely too late as well.
Mm.
It was always going to be a kind of shoe-in for someone like George Galloway.
Yeah.
Because he is actually a very good speaker. He unfortunately is a very good speaker in some regards. He has a really checkered past in terms of what he's done and how he's done it. Hold on a sec. Just rearranging myself on the chair. I've got a dead leg. And so I think, generally what he stands for, I would hope, won't resonate beyond what's left of this election, what's left of this parliament before the general election, and that this is just a bit of a protest to say, you can't take us for granted. We won't accept the nonsense that's been going on at length. But
think that we thought, well, I've said to you so many times, every month you think, it can't get that worse, it can't get any worse. I think that for the next 6 months, we are going to see the most unbelievable circumstances, situations arising. So watch this space.
Watch this space indeed. And moving on to what we'll see over the next 6 months, wonderfully segued in there. We discussed, I think, over the last couple of podcasts, various matters around, obviously, the issues of finance in local government. And what I think what we're going to touch on with what's left after talking about chicken nonstop of this podcast is just to go through some of the things that have been happening in the past kind of few days. There's been a new kind of report into the use of, basically the process of councils selling off assets to try and, especially at this budget kind of period, to try and meet the budget constraints they have and the shortfall that they have. And there's been some work done by the Local Government Chronicle to look at actually how councils are selling off assets such as Birmingham City Council, that they're, I think, selling off around £750 million worth of assets to try and bridge the funding gaps that they have. And that actually, you know, this isn't necessarily the best thing for the council to be doing, because ultimately they're a one-time asset. So whatever they get this time, like next time, they're still going to have to bridge that gap and potentially more in the next financial year. So this is a kind of one-time fire sale. And actually, we're seeing a lot of councils, such as district councils, doing a very similar thing, which actually I don't think is a bad thing, because a lot of them are then passing off their assets to kind of town and parish councils, which I actually think is really good for the communities to maintain kind of public buildings and public spaces. I did see a report, and I forget which London borough it was, who actually didn't even have an asset list of the buildings, the commercial buildings that they owned. They didn't have it all in one place. So I'll block that name out. But I can't remember where it was, but basically they just didn't have a list of the assets they had, which tells you an awful lot. But I think generally, you know, unless it is going to another public body, such as a town or parish council, the loss of assets which are owned by the public, you know, unless they are office blocks, etc., where they'll generate a profit through sale, which otherwise would kind of decline in terms of value, or will actually start to cost the council to run and operate, and therefore it's good to get rid of assets that are no longer performing in the way that the council want. I think it's a real loss to communities and to cities, like more generally, when they're doing things like this. Financial position next year is going to be an awful lot more difficult.
And I think it's
going to have a lot less wiggle room.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more worrying for next year. Like 750 million, that's just an enormous amount of money that I don't see the necessity to sell all of it. And they have to think about that, you know, could they not have generated further income from those assets? I haven't seen the list of the assets that they're going to.
No, I mean, to be fair, the majority of them, like I think pretty much all of them are actually paying, like, the council something. I think, you know, a number of community groups are doing assets of community value, etc. So these are often public spaces which community groups are using, as opposed to just long-term assets.
Does this mean that the council is going to have that £750 million to put back into their coffers, or is it just we're getting rid of that because that's costing us money and we can't afford that money anymore? So are they then auctioning it off? Are they selling it to the community users, or are they selling it onto business enterprises? Is it being done by auction? Is it being done by secret deals? You know, sealed bids.
Don't say secret deals.
No, that doesn't over here.
But
does it?
I think it's a mix.
So many questions. I think that to be able to say they're right or they're wrong.
I mean, there is never a one size fits all with this. I think the majority of businesses that the majority of assets that are costing the money will already have gone. Often these are generating like sums, but nothing like the kind of cash injection that the council currently needs. There has been a big push for kind of community ownership and community groups to try and take things on, such as pubs and community centres, to try and then retain it for kind of the social fabric of the city. And not just speaking about Birmingham there, but it's a kind of case in point. But obviously, a lot of these kind of spaces tend to be the ones that aren't generating as big a profits as some of the more commercial enterprises. So it is more likely that the ones which are used by community groups are going to be the first to be sold off, because they often aren't paying a commercial rent for it. So that's why I think this kind of sale is going to have a much bigger impact across the country, not specifically in Birmingham, but more generally, because they are going to be turning out the assets which basically don't generate so much that they're going to meaningfully assist in plugging the gap. And so the kind of basically the price of the asset being sold for best value, which is what they often need to kind of provide, actually will decrease the amount of community use of public buildings. And you'll likely find them being turned into, you know, potentially housing, potentially being taken on by businesses and being used for business use, which in itself may not be a terrible thing, but it very much depends upon the types of businesses that are bringing on. But generally, you can't escape the claws of developers at the moment.
No, but no, that's the other horrendous thing, isn't it? That some of them will be sold off and then utilised for developers to come along and say, oh, it needs to be more housing. And you're then putting more houses into a community. I appreciate that you're getting the council tax that comes along with it, but then you still have all the other issues that come along with it as well.
Yeah, you do.
I think it worries me that with Birmingham Council getting themselves into the situation that they did in the first place, is this another error of judgment, thinking this is going to be a way of getting out of it? You know, are they forward planning? I'm not so sure. But I really think that every council from, you know, from the first tier up to county should be sitting down and working out what is the best way for them to sustain themselves, as opposed to be sitting thinking, what, you know, we need more money from government. Every council should be sitting thinking, how are we going to bring money in ourselves? Even if it is just, as we've said so many times before, organising events that's going to cost you money, but you're going to make good money out of it, that then can go on to, you know, to better the community around you.
I tend to think that, you know, looking at the way some decisions have been made historically, not currently at Birmingham, but historically, and not just in Birmingham, but some of the other councils which have served Section 114 notices, it always kind of, I'm always struck by the fact that often the amount of due diligence done at the higher tiers of local government, where there perhaps isn't as much kind of public scrutiny as there is at the first tier, I just don't think the due diligence is done the same way. I don't think a small town or parish council would get away with making decisions in the way that some district and county councils have. And I think that's why returning some assets, say returning, but actually, you know, delivering some assets down to town and parish councils is actually going to guarantee them for an awful lot longer than it would with the way that district and counties are looking at the moment. And it kind of leads us on to the fact that, you know, Section 114 notices, you know, they aren't a thing of the past. There's recent studies that have looked at, you know, feedback from council leaders and council chief executives that have said that they're looking at perhaps 58% being likely to issue Section 114 notices within the next 5 years.
But just interrupting you there, that last few words, they're likely to issue Section 114 within the next 5 years. How can they possibly be planning that they might be in that situation in the next 5 years?
I think what it comes down to is looking at the trends in terms of local government finance. They will all have plans that should extend to beyond 5 years in terms of their financial planning, in terms of what they will need to be able to cover the services that they're providing with the current rate of inflation the way it is. They will be calculating all of this out, because that they have to basically try and address the long-term financial picture that they're going to be facing and how tight that's going to be. And there are some councils that will have good reserves, and we know some really well-run district councils have those. And there are some that are probably looking at it and thinking, well, you know, we're making ends meet now, but if things continue the way they are at the moment, we aren't going to be able to keep up with the 5% that we're able to put onto council tax with certain variations in terms of like social care. We're not able to achieve, you know, with 5% anywhere near the type of money that we need to kind of keep up with the increased costs that we're incurring, and the increase kind of basically staffing costs, the increased costs in delivering certain services, and even energy, heating, vehicles, petrol, things like that. You know, we just aren't able to do it. And the government have been very clear about the financial settlement that we can expect in local government. And although there has been some good news in terms of what the government will do over the last kind of week, you know, in the next 5 years, none of that is certain. You know, we can't really even say what government's going to be in, you know, next year. Can't. So you can't make any kind of judgments. And so you have to go with worst case scenario. And that makes it likely that they'll be issuing Section 114s within the next 5 years. But I think just to kind of combine the two stories together, I mean, what seems to really strike me at the moment is we have on one hand, you know, councils selling off assets and often passing them down to town and parish councils. And a lot of district councils are now looking to do that as urgently as possible. So therefore, these councils will be holding less public assets, which the community kind of have come to rely on. You often then have county councils that are delivering similar services. So county councils, for instance, in terms of a three-tier system, will have planning. They will have certain responsibilities around, you know, waste, and they'll have a more strategic view of these things in terms of like incinerators and waste disposal and tips and kind of things like that. So actually, you start to look at what district councils are delivering solely, you know, and actually there isn't an awful lot that a county won't be doing some part of. And if they're not doing any part of it, they could be doing it. So you look at things like economic development. You know, a county will have an economic development team, and you'll have a district with an economic development team. And often you'll have maybe five districts, each with their own economic development officer, because everyone likes economic development because it sounds very good and it makes it sound like, you know, full of business support. So, you know, you're duplicating all of this. And I'm just wondering whether with the premise of greater Section 114 notices, a lack of promise of investment from central government and asset stripping as it's going at the moment, do we think that there's going to be a time in the next few years where actually you won't have district councils, you will just have unitary authorities, which seems to be going the way of, you know, areas having like directly elected mayors, having directly elected leaders of councils? And will we start to see the demise of district councils? And in a way, is this underinvestment in local government forcing the sale of assets down to town and parish, which traditionally will always be untouched in local government reorganisation? And a lot of services going up then to the county for more strategic things. I wouldn't be surprised if some planning went down to town and parish councils. It's already happening in areas like Lincolnshire. Mm-hmm. And town and parishes do things like, you know, your small extensions, your kind of canopy porches, your minor kind of changes. And actually the big strategic stuff is done by county. And before you know where you are, you don't really need a district council anymore because they don't have the assets. Their services are being duplicated anyway. And with the community right challenge to undertake some of these things as well, you know, is this the end game really that we're looking at in terms of financing local government? Is it just a kind of an avenue to force the reorganisation, which otherwise may be kind of, well, resisted?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think that it probably is something that we will see over the next 5-6 years. And if we don't, then somebody's going to have to come up with some serious
money, cash,
some serious investments to make it work, because it is just not feasible anymore to be in that situation. And when whenever you compare, like you said, the duplication of the jobs for the district to the county. And again, well, we've said this before, if you give more authority to the local, the first tier of government, then it's definitely the way forward. But we shall see. Again, it's a civil servant thing, isn't it? It needs somebody to come up with to get it around.
You know, and I think the more we're seeing, two district councils sharing, sometimes more than two district councils sharing an officer team.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can have to drive for, potentially an hour to get to your council office in order to see someone. Most things are done online now.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't turn up to district council offices and sit and wait. In fact, if you look at the receptions in most district councils, they're almost non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that actually, every other area in kind of the public realm, courts, police stations, they've all closed. You have to travel that much mm-hmm. further to get to any of them. And actually, I just think local government is likely to go the same way. We went through a process of having the rural district councils.
Mm-hmm.
That was then reorganized and we ended up with the district councils we have now. And I just think the next logical step, unfortunately, and this isn't in any way, shape or form, me advocating for it happening. But I just wonder whether, the current model of kind of local governance is going to change irreparably. And actually, that will be, I think, really poor for local democracy. But then I also think, the public purse can only stretch so far.
But it doesn't have to be all doom and gloom. You're just taking the cost of the running the premises, paying the wages, and if needs must, you can expand whenever it comes to the county side of things. So you're just bringing it all under one roof. So it's not necessarily all doom and gloom, but whenever you put into, like I said, the duplication and the cost, if we're going to have to do cost savings, then maybe, an hour, you say you have to drive sometimes an hour to get to your district office. Well, you probably do the same to get to the county. So, why have 10 minutes up the road a district office whenever you can just do everything under the one roof at county?
I agree with you.
I think that's very good. I think that probably is something that we will see.
Don't say that. People are going to be really unhappy with you saying it's good to get rid of the district.
You came up with the idea. Especially. So it's all your fault.
Especially when you're looking
Rishi's
at...
listening.
No, we've blocked his downloads. It's fine. Don't worry.
It's all your fault.
But I think, the people who I feel most sorry for, if that happened, is the leaders and the deputy leaders of district councils. But in some ways, it may be a good thing for them, because as we saw with Cheshire East kind of district council this week, the deputy leader says he can't live on the £30,000 he gets as deputy leader, and so has had to step down in order to find other employment. Mm-hmm. And so just in the last few minutes of this podcast, do you think that, you've been in the cabinet of a district council? I mean, my view is you have full-time paid officers, like you have managing directors or chief executives who run that side of the kind of the officer court, the head of paid service side of things. Do you really think that the leader and deputy leader of district councils can't do part-time work alongside and solely have to live on the allowance that they get as leader and deputy leader. Don't you think you can balance both? But I mean, ultimately, if you take it as your only job, you're on a fixed-term contract. You know, you if you get voted out, you know, what do you have to show for it?
This is it.
You know, that's it.
Yeah. No, I don't think that whenever I went on the cabinet, I had every intentions of leaving the job that I was doing and just focusing on that side of it. But then something in the back of my head said, don't be silly. You can work this. You can work around this. And I did. Luckily, I was able to, if there was a tea time meeting, I was able to leave early. Or if there was a morning meeting, then I'd go into work late. I was lucky that my managers were accepting that I could have a bit of freedom to come and go.
I mean, like you say, you kind of double check that before you take on the role. So before you take on the role of, say, deputy leader, which is 30K,
look at
your existing job.
But
I mean, to be fair, I don't think there's that much difference between, you know, you're a portfolio holder for planning, for heaven's sake. I mean, there isn't much busier in the district council.
The busiest portfolio, I'll have you know.
It is. You know, the only people that work harder than you is everyone else.
No, in all seriousness, it is that, you know, there is an issue getting younger people to be counsellors and then to have the time to go further up the tree. But you can do it. You know, you can do it. So, excuse me, that you're... That you can juggle both of them, but you have to be dedicated to it. You know, you have to be prepared to give everything to it. But I wouldn't ever say to anybody, you know, give up your job that you were doing pre getting elected or pre getting to be the leader, and focus totally on that, because it could change. You only have a 4-year slot. And again, it doesn't mean to say that you've got that position for 4 years. All it needs is that the group that put you in as leader might not want you to stay leader for the 4 years.
Absolutely.
And then you're back to square one, where you could just be on the back benches, where you're just getting the minimum as an allowance, not a wage.
It is an allowance, not a wage, which in itself should tell you where your priorities need to be. But also, and this is just a kind of a by the by, but who on earth at the moment, when you have so many council officers that are paid far less in a lot of instances than £30,000, comes out and says, sorry, I can't live on what I basically accept other people in this organization being paid. It's okay for them to have it, like £20,000, perhaps sometimes even less than that.
Yeah.
They can live off that, but I can't live off 30, so I'll just kind of leave rather than advocate for, you know, we need staff to be paid more, because if I'm struggling on 30,000, imagine how these people are who are on 20,000. You know, instead of thinking about that and trying to bring people up, he's just basically stepped down and said, I can't live off 30,000, I'm going to go away and earn a lot more. Never mind the fact that he's stepping down from a council which pays people significantly less than 30K. I just think it's completely kind of detached from the people that he both serves and works with.
Incredible. And being the leader of a council, you are just the leader. You have a CEO, you have a managing director who is doing all the hard work, making sure that the teams
sure about that.
Allegedly. But, you know, doing all...
Have you met some of them?
But if they're not doing the job, then as leader, you're the one that's supposed to be saying to them, look, pull your finger out.
Absolutely.
If the cabinet or the council told you to do this, why have you not done it? What's the explanations for it? That's what the leader's responsibility is. But you're paying you're paying pretty high wages to the people in the top positions in the district councils. So, you know, they have a responsibility to earn that money. And I do think 30,000 is a huge amount for a leader to be being paid. I don't think I don't think that's acceptable at all.
Thank you for listening to the Standing Orders podcast by Politis. Please like and subscribe to get your weekly edition. You can suggest topics by emailing podcast@politisconsulting.co.uk. See you next week.